The suite hadn't changed at all in the time that he'd been gone. It was both comforting and unsettling at the same time. At least there was something familiar, the sleek blue sofa in the lounge, the rows of books, some of which were even his. The curtains over the French doors leading out to the balcony. At the same time, it was strange to be standing in a place that was so untouched when he himself felt so different. It was hard to think back to the naive kid he'd been, the one who'd loved it there and couldn't wait to make the move permanent. Tom walked to the French doors and pushed the curtains aside, digging his fingers into the lush blackout fabric as he peered out into the darkness. There were floodlights around the dandy property, more to deter human criminals than to keep the vampires from stumbling across the grounds. He didn't know if they were intended to have the added bonus of keeping the house staff safe. Probably not. They were disposable, after all. The vampires would never run out of desperate hangers-on. Kids or even adults with sharp eyes and imaginations that allowed them to believe some of the whispered gossip they'd hear in clubs or on the streets. Tom wondered how often the staff had changed since he'd been gone. He'd only seen one person so far, and he'd recognized her. Maybe the others were still around, too. Did that make them lucky? Forcing his fingers to unclench, Tom let go of the curtains and threw the doors open. A strong breeze blew in, throwing his hair around his head. It was long, way past stylishly shaggy. He loved being able to grow it out, to watch as outside appearances changed to match the new person he'd become. Unconsciously, his hand came up and skimmed the ring in his nose, the one in his lip. His lip twinged, the flesh around the piercing not at all happy to be touched. The sharp ache felt kind of nice. With a sigh, he stepped out onto the balcony, half sitting on the railing, watching as something moved in the darkness outside. He squinted a little, trying to make out the dark little lump as it chased something, moving closer to a pool of light from the flood lamps. It was a cat. Tom shook his head. It belongs to Siska, the butcher's fledgling. The voice startled Tom so badly that he nearly pitched himself over the balcony railing. Strong hands steadied him, allowing him to slide his feet to the ground and regain his balance. Tom tensed at that, but Mike didn't try anything, just stepped away as soon as Tom was able to stand on his own. There's another one around here somewhere. It took Tom a moment to figure out that Mike was still talking about cats. Tom shrugged with a jerky motion and wrapped his arms around himself before realizing that it sent the wrong message. He dropped them back to his sides. "We're the talk of the house, it seems," Mike said, moving around Tom to lean against the railing. "There hasn't been this much excitement in a while." "I don't care," Tom said. "Of course, Briar tends to cause a stir wherever he goes," Mike continued, ignoring Tom's statement. "The last time he was here, he almost killed Brendan's boy." Tom's head came up at that, but he didn't say anything. "He likes to plot, he and his friends. We have him to thank for John's coup, in a roundabout way." Mike's tone was conversational, as though they were discussing the weather. "There's something you want to ask?" Tom said sharply. "There's a lot of things I want to ask," Mike replied. "I'm just skeptical about whether or not I'll get a truthful answer. You've already told more lies than I can count tonight." "Self-preservation," Tom said. "I finally learned what it is." "Oh, you already had that," Mike drawled. "It was misplaced for a few months while you were busy getting drunk every night and angry at the world for hating little fags with pretty mouths. But it came back eventually. right around the time you let me take you home and show you another way to live, another way to get back at them. You see, revenge doesn't work if you're the only one hurting Tom. We've had this conversation already. Yeah, Tom said. We did. But we also had another conversation. One where you said you'd stay away from him if I came back here without kicking up a fuss. There was no need to explain which him Tom was referring to. He clenched his jaw and tried to take deep, even breaths. It wasn't fair. He'd never be able to hide behind this new persona, this new Tom, if Mike could make him think of that other life so easily. Tom wasn't even sure that it had been Mike's intention to bring it up, though it was likely. There were too many hurt feelings, too much tattered pride, for things to be completely accidental. I'll keep my word, Mike said. I'm capable of that. Tom snorted at that, and he knew immediately that it was the wrong reaction. The anger in the vampire's face was dark, terrifying, much worse than anything Tom had seen in the past. He kept his hands to himself, though, for which Tom was ridiculously grateful. Don't you even dare, Mike hissed. I never lied to you. I never hid what I am or what this life is about. You did, Tom said softly, hating himself for how afraid his voice sounded. It was hard to be brave when there was so much anger directed at him. Those people, you never said it was like that. They didn't have to be so scared. Did you think we would ask them politely to spare a pint? Mike demanded. I live on human blood, Tom. I'm a fucking vampire. I know that, Tom yelled. He'd never been that stupid, that naive, no matter how much he might have romanticized it in his fucked up head. But there are ways to make it better for them. I heard people say it. It's hard to lie to them when there are 8 other people being fed from in the same room, Mike said, sighing deeply, almost wearily. Then why do it? Tom asked. It doesn't have to be that way. And if I told you they were the scum of human society, child rapists and murderers, would that make it any better? Mike asked. Were they? Tom asked warily. How should I know? They didn't apply for the position, Mike replied. But you can feed off that if it makes you happy. Nate likes blondes. Michael's developed a thing for girls with blue eyes. It's a preference, just like any other. You can work around it. I don't want to work around it, Tom snapped. I don't want it at all. Yeah, Brendan's voice says the same thing, Mike scoffed. Tom took note of that, filed it away, and tried to settle his feelings of all-out fucking joy at the revelation. Brendan thinks it's his dirty little secret, but we all know about it. Here he's an open book when it comes to that kid. It doesn't matter, though, because do you know what's going to happen in the end, Tom? Brendan's going to get tired of waiting, and Ryan's going to take what's given to him. He'll wake up happy, because instinct will take over, and he won't have any of the stupid worries he has right now. Life will go on. Tom pictured the boy on the stairs, the one who seemed to have more freedom than anyone in his position should rightfully have, with a countdown hanging over his head. Tom's resolve grew that much stronger. He had to do something. Maybe if he could get through to Ryan, he'd take the other kid and run. That your answer for everything? Instinct? Tom asked. Yes, Mike replied, pushing away from the railing and heading back inside.
What about Pete?
The words stopped Mike in the doorway.
Pete Wentz is a category all of his own,
the vampire said simply.
Tom supposed that was right, in a way.
He didn't know much about Wentz, just what he'd picked up around the house and from Mike's vague warnings. But it was enough to know he was a sore spot for all the dandies.
So what happens now?
Tom forced himself to ask. Mike was back inside, moving aimlessly around the lounge, picking things up and putting them back down again. He was quiet for several long minutes, almost as though he had no idea how to answer the question.
You'll stay here,
Mike finally said. That door will be locked during the day, just in case the house staff isn't as trustworthy as we think they are. In case you're not as trustworthy, hung in the air between them. In the evenings, you'll have the run of the house. There's always someone here, after all, so it's hardly a risk to let you wander. For some reason, Tom hadn't expected that much leniency. He thought back to the boy, Ryan, even though their situations weren't alike at all.
And you?
Tom asked, giving voice to something that bothered him more than a little.
I'm not stupid, Tom. I won't be sleeping anywhere near you. I happen to like this life.
He smiled a little, the expression unsettling Tom more than he wanted to admit. He turned then, making his way to the door. He pulled a keyring from his pocket and shuffled through three keys until he found the one he was looking for. The lock on the suite door was a double-cylinder deadbolt, with a keyhole on both sides. It didn't take long before Tom realized what he was doing.
Wait, he blurted. It's night. You said I'd be allowed out. So you can talk to Briar and get your story straight?
Not likely, Tom. Not tonight. Mike opened the door to the suite and fit his key into the outside cylinder.
Tonight, you can sit tight. Someone will be along to feed you.
If Tom flinched when the key turned, he was glad that no one was around to see it. He spent the rest of the night on the balcony, straining to hear whatever little snippets of conversation floated out from the other suites. It wasn't much, just some laughter, scraps of mockery, and sex from the rooms next door. But around 4, he caught the sound of urgent whispers. There was someone on the balcony above him, pleading in frustration for someone to just pay attention. Tom didn't recognize the voices, but he held completely still, his back pressed against the doorway, making himself as small as possible on the off chance that someone would know he was there. He wasn't able to make out actual words, nothing beyond "listen" and "isolated," before the vampires moved back into the third floor suite to continue their argument. He fell asleep out there, some time before the grandfather clock in the lounge struck 5, curled up in the corner between the house and the railing. His back ached when he finally woke, the sun high in the sky, casting a red glow against his closed eyelids. Tom groaned as he straightened up, stretching his stiff muscles and rubbing at his itchy eyes. His body felt sluggish, his mind wrapped in cotton wool. He'd gotten more sleep during late-night study sessions, or all-nighters spent frantically searching for inspiration, or trying to use his camera to capture life the way he saw it with his actual eyes. Tom was smiling, shaking his head as he thought of his 11 a.m. classes with Professor Grierson, and how he'd always made it just in the nick of time to drop off his work. Eventually, the professor had come to expect it, and would wait a few extra minutes before closing the door to the classroom.
Tell me, Tom, did you fall asleep before or after sunup this morning?
He asked with a small smile.
Staying up past 6 would just be irresponsible, sir,
Tom replied innocently. I have a scholarship to keep. A smile slid from Tom's face, and he stared at his shoes. That was gone. He had to stop thinking about it. Maybe that would get easier in time. The sound of a key sliding into the lock on the Swede's door brought Tom's head up suddenly. He bolted from his spot on the balcony, making his way to the middle of the lounge, shuffling his weight from foot to foot. It had to be one of the house staff, but which one? Tom wasn't sure if he wanted it to be one of his former friends or not. As the young woman pushed open the door, Tom sighed and realized he'd actually been hoping for a stranger.
Greta, Tom said.
They told me you came back, Greta said with a small smile. She had trouble keeping the expression together, as though she didn't know whether to be happy or sad about that. Tom thought of asking her about it, but kept it to himself instead.
Came back makes it sound like this was my decision, Tom said.
He watched Greta set a tray carefully down on a polished wood coffee table that stood in front of the blue sofa.
I came back to bury my grandmother.
It was said to shock her, and Greta didn't disappoint. She gasped, a hand coming to her mouth as she watched him with wide eyes. Greta Salpeter was one of the only people Tom had ever mentioned his grandmother to. He hadn't said much, but it was impossible to talk about her without giving away how much he cared.
It doesn't look like I'll even be able to do that,
Tom continued.
Oh, Tom, what happened?
Greta asked as she came around the couch and gave him a hug. Tom was stiff for a moment before putting his arms around her slender form, hugging her back. It made him feel marginally better, which in turn made him feel like a stupid kid. There was nothing magical about a hug. It shouldn't have drained some of the tension from his body or made his mind feel a little bit clearer.
What do you think happened, Greta?
He asked, forcing himself to take a step away from her, his hands gripping her waist firmly to keep her from following him.
No, she said, shaking her head. Her death was the only thing that would bring me back here,
Tom said, his voice raising more than he wanted. There was no point in yelling at Greta. She'd never done him any harm.
But no buts, Tom snapped. He told me he did it. And right now she's lying in a fucking morgue because I can't pay for her funeral.
Maybe, Greta began. Tom laughed bitterly. Greta grit her teeth against it.
What, should I ask Mike to pay?
He asked.
I'm not so sure the dandies go in for that, Greta. After all, they'd be broke within the month if they buried everyone they murdered.
That's not fair, Greta snapped. Not everyone is.
Why are you still here?
Tom interrupted. Greta looked as though he'd slapped her, and Tom felt some of his anger drain away.
Not here like the suite, but here like this house.
Greta's eyes slid away from Tom's, focusing on the floor, her feet, the sofa, the wall.
Who did you get mixed up with?
Tom asked, voice gentling a little. He reached out and touched her elbow. Greta looked up at that.
You don't know him,
Greta said softly. His name is Nate. He's new.
And what does his sire have to say about dear Nate getting mixed up with the help?
It was unnecessarily harsh, but in that moment, Tom wanted to reach out and shake her, just until she realized how dangerous the game she was playing really was. In Beckett's time, none of the dandies would have even thought to mess around with the humans. They needed people who were objective, who wouldn't be put in position to learn something that could later be told to the wrong person.
Nate's sire is dead, Greta said flatly. And no one else has complained so far.
Tom raised an eyebrow.
How do you know that? He asked. Do you really think an orphan is going to go against the gang?
Greta demanded.
He depends on each and every one of them. And who do you depend on?
Tom asked.
What?
Greta asked, obviously confused with the shift in questioning.
Well, the gang keeps Nate safe, so who keeps you safe?
Tom pressed. He reached out and took hold of Greta's hands, holding tightly, trying to convey the seriousness of the situation to her.
It's not going to be you, if that's what you're getting at,
Greta said, taking a step back and tugging her hands free.
Your brilliant idea was to run away, to Brian Schechter, of all people. Did you see him when you were gone?
No, Tom said automatically.
Too bad. He's scary as hell. Even the vampires around here talk about him in quiet voices. It makes me think he's some kind of monster.
Greta shuddered.
He's just smart,
Tom said, the words slipping out of his mouth before he could stop them.
Really?
Greta said suspiciously.
Knowledge is power, isn't it?
Tom said, shrugging and trying to seem bored with the idea already. He must have done a good job of it, because Greta shrugged too.
That vampire he sent is a pain in the ass, she said, driving everyone crazy with his questions and his wandering.
Wandering? Tom asked.
Yeah, he's been looking around since he got here, nosing around places he's got no business being. He seems to like harassing Cardin, but Brendan and John seem to be fair game too. He was out for a few hours last night. Everyone seemed happy to see him go.
Hmm, Tom said. What was Briar up to? Nosing around the house made sense, if Schechter was after some kind of information. But where had he disappeared to? Was he relaying information to someone? Or was he just finding ways to entertain himself that didn't involve being around Tom?
Mike's words came back to him. So you can talk to Briar and get your story straight? Not likely, Tom.
Maybe he just wanted to throw off suspicion. Bob Briar had no use for humans. Tom imagined it must be irritating to have been linked to one, especially one like Tom.
You ran away, and now that your city has changed hands, you stand to bring a heap of trouble to this one.
Tom had no idea what Briar was planning, but he knew it couldn't be good for him. The vampire had made his thoughts on Tom painfully clear.
So, do I at least get to meet this Nate?
Tom asked, after an uncomfortable silence, during which Greta continued to look at Tom unhappily, as though she couldn't quite figure something out about him. Tom didn't want her to hate him. If she did, she'd never listen to him. He'd already put her name on his list, right after Ryan and Spencer. The words had the opposite effect that he'd intended. Greta looked so incredibly sad for a moment, and then turned and hurried toward the door. Tom held out a hand to stop her, but she shrugged it off.
Greta?
He asked. She paused in the doorway, holding tightly to the knob.
Nate didn't come home last night, she said softly.
And then she was gone. If Tom was upset about being shut in the suite last night, he was even angrier after Greta left. There was nothing to do except pace and think, neither of which were making him feel any better. He wasn't interested in any of the books in the bookcase, not even the ones he'd left there himself. There were a few paperback novels, stupid things like Stephen King that had made Mike laugh, or J.D. Robb, which had made him snort and then laugh. but also several hardcover photography books. Those made him sick to his stomach. Photography was a beautiful thing, an art. It didn't belong here. He did his best to keep from thinking about school or his other life, but he was unable to keep from thinking about Greta, the sad tilt to her mouth and the brightness of her eyes. Nate hadn't come home, she said. How had she found out? At dawn? No, that didn't make sense. Even as a fledgling, Nate wouldn't be dumb enough to sleep next to a human. Had Greta been told when she'd shown up for work? Most of the humans didn't live in the house. There were usually outbuildings on the property or apartments nearby. Tom wanted to ask, but it wasn't Greta who showed up to bring him dinner. It was the girl he'd seen with Lacey the day before. Up close, she was hardly as pretty as she'd seemed. Her hair a dull brown, her eyes muddy and unattractive. Vampires liked pretty things, and this girl didn't fit the bill. Tom breathed a sigh of relief when he realized there was no way Lacey was planning to keep her. The thought gave him pause. Either option had an equally dangerous outcome. Was he really suggesting that ending up dead was better than being turned? Tom was horrified to realize he was capable of passing so much judgment. "So you're," he began, intent on filling her out, deciding if her name would go on his list, too. "Don't even start with me," the girl snapped. "I don't want none of what you're selling. I saw what you did to poor Greta."
"I didn't,"
Tom said, suddenly wanting to defend himself.
"You did," she said curtly. "Eat your dinner or don't."
She eyed the half-full tray that Greta had left.
"I don't care. Just keep your opinions to yourself."
And that was that. He didn't even ask for her name. At sunset, true to his word, Mike unlocked the door to the suite. He threw Tom an unreadable look, which made the boy think that maybe someone had told him about Greta and the girl with no name, but he didn't say anything about it.
"I'm going out," he said.
Tom bit back a sarcastic reply.
"You have the house. If you can handle that, maybe you'll be allowed out on the grounds."
His tone of voice told Tom that he didn't seem hopeful of that happening. Tom didn't care. Even being able to roam the house was appealing at the moment, after having spent so much time in the suite. Mike disappeared soon after making his pronouncement, but Tom forced himself to spend another half hour on the balcony, not wanting to seem too grateful for the opportunity to leave. He sat on the railing for a while, thinking back to the night before, and the argument he'd heard coming from the suite directly above him. Had it been about Nate? Had someone gotten worried even before dawn? If Nate was a fledgling, it would make sense. The Andes tended to keep close tabs on their young ones. When the young one in question was an orphan, there were more eyes trained in their direction. Tom wished he could ask someone. Maybe if he found Greta again, and she was actually willing to talk to him. Once his 30 minutes were up, Tom carefully set a comfortable pace and made his way out of the suite. He took his time in wandering the corridors, trying various doors to see if they were locked. Most of them were, but he did manage to find an unlocked music room with an assortment of acoustic guitars and a lovely grand piano. He didn't linger, but kept it in mind for later. It had been a while since he'd played, but he was confident that he hadn't gotten too bad in the last year. As soon as he'd finished exploring the second floor, Tom stood near the staircase and debated whether to go up or down. The third floor was likely mostly suites as well, but there was always a chance that he'd find something unexpected, like the music room. On the other hand, the first floor had the parlors, the kitchen, and the front door. He could watch people coming and going, take stock of who was still at the house and what their routines were. The information would do him little good, but it might help one of the kids, or even Greta. Mind made up, he headed down, gripping tightly to the railing, and doing his best to block out memories of every eye on him, as he'd made his way up just last night. There was no one in the foyer as Tom made his way down to the first floor, and he wasn't entirely sure whether that was a good thing or not. He'd just stepped onto the polished wood floor of the entryway when he heard John Walker's voice coming from the larger of the two parlors on either side of the foyer. Tom moved slowly, quietly, not wanting to draw attention to himself. If there was a meeting, maybe they were discussing the missing fledgling. "We have no proof that it was Wentz," John said, his tone sharp as though he'd said it more than once already. "But..." It was the butcher, and he sounded as irritated as John himself. "If you want to hunt him down, go ahead," John said. "He has slighted you enough for that, and this gang has been far too permissive with his actions as it is. But I am not going to issue an edict, not for him." "What about Felix?" Butcher pressed. "Maya's envoy is still dead." "If I thought for a minute that this was about Felix, you'd have a point," John said. "But unless everyone here has forgotten, I wasn't in charge when that happened. I'm not going to start going over past events and doling out punishments that I feel are fitting. If Maya wants to take that up with me, she can." The butcher looked as though he was going to protest again, but John cut him off once more. It was clearly an argument they'd been having for some time. "He injured Siska. I understand how angry you are about that. You two are the last of your line, after all. If you want to take that up with Wentz, go ahead."
"I would if I could find him," the butcher retorted. "It seems he's disappeared."
"Tough break," Ryer replied. "Yes," the butcher said slowly. "Tough break indeed. I don't suppose you have any information to share?"
"No,"
Ryer said simply.
"Don't lie to me," the butcher yelled.
Tom bit back a gasp at the fury in his face. He crouched down lower and continued to peer around the doorway.
"You reeked of his people when you came back to the house last night."
"I never denied finding the hunters," Ryer said. "My business is my own."
"Bullshit," the butcher spat. "Are you one of us or one of them?"
Ryer looked down at his clothes and then looked back to the butcher.
"I don't see a hoodie and girls' jeans, so I'm going to assume that you weren't actually asking that question."
"He almost killed my family," Butcher pressed.
"Didn't he also kill yours?"
"Oh." Tom bit his lip and leaned out a little farther, not wanting to miss the answer.
Could that be it, the reason the border was closed? Tom didn't know a lot about the vampires, but he did know that family, fledglings, sires, grandsires, siblings, were important. "Yes," Briar snarled. "But I am more fortunate than you, Butcher. I have more than one sad little boy in my line. I have Schechter, Gabriel, Gerard. Have you already forgotten who marked those hunters?"
"No," the butcher said, shaking his head in disbelief. It took Tom a moment to realize that he wasn't actually answering Briar's question.
"There is no way that you're claiming Pete Wentz is your blood."
Ryer snorted at that, the sound making Tom raise his eyebrows in surprise. He'd never have pegged Briar for such an indelicate sound.
"Of course not," he said. "But those boys are, until such time as Gerard gives them up or keeps them permanently. I'm not stupid, you know. I'm well aware of the fact that they won't make it out alive if I help you to find Wentz."
"Walker?" The butcher turned to John and had a silent conversation with him, one comprised of dire looks and arched eyebrows.
We can't force him to tell us, John said finally. He is right about the blood claim. Family is family. Lose the smug look, Briar, now.
Everyone else in the parlor went quiet as John turned his attention back to the envoy. His look of satisfaction shifted to one of lazy surprise.
Your line seems to thrive on technicalities, he continued. But we're not stupid either. It's only going to get you so far before it backfires.
Are you threatening me?
Briar asked softly, dangerously.
Of course not, John said brusquely. That would be impolite. What would Schechter say?
What indeed? Briar mused. He might start with asking why no one bothered to make sure this meeting was at least semi-secret.
He looked over at Tom then, smiling a little to see him crouched down, nearly on his knees.
Tom, Mike said flatly.
I'm still in the house. I haven't done anything wrong, Tom thought about saying. But the last thing he wanted was to be confined to the suite all day and all night.
He stood up, brushed some imaginary dirt from his jeans, and hurried away.
Someone needs to bathe him, Tom heard someone say.
Rich, coming from you, another one replied. I remember you as a human. Everyone thought Lacey was insane for wanting to turn you.
Tom didn't hear any more of the argument. He hurried up the stairs, intent on exploring the third floor, and possibly the attic, before heading back down to the music room. It was nearing dawn when he stumbled into the kitchen and set about putting together a tray of things to bring up to the suite. They hadn't seemed keen on feeding him at decent times, so he'd just have to take care of that himself. He was piling fruit and crackers, cheese and juice onto the counter, when two of the humans on the dandy payroll wandered into the kitchen from the back door. They spoke quietly amongst themselves, either unaware or uncaring that Tom was there. Tom recognized one as the girl with no name, and figured that the servants were just pretending he didn't exist. Tom busied himself by putting his food onto a small white tray, keeping one ear out to eavesdrop.
Second day in a row, the girl with no name said to her blonde friend. Rotten luck, maybe?
Maybe, but Greta... Greta was a sentimental fool. I wouldn't be surprised if someone found her shoes on Samson Bridge.
Samson isn't high enough to kill yourself, the blonde girl scoffed.
I never said she was bright, did I?
The girl with no name laughed.
What was that?
Tom snapped, breaking into their conversation. The women glared at him for eavesdropping.
You mean you haven't heard? My, why ever would Cardin keep anything from you?
The girl with no name asked, feigning shock.
You'd think people didn't like you very much.
I don't need to be liked,
Tom said, gritting his teeth. He stepped away from the counter and moved toward the girls, using every inch of extra height he had. He knew that he should be ashamed of himself for trying to intimidate a woman, but he tried not to listen to that part of his brain.
What happened to Greta?
She should have been here an hour ago. Her apartment is empty,
the blonde said, shrinking back against the wall.
So you think...
Tom asked, leaving his question open for the girl to fill in with her own interpretation.
That she killed herself, yeah,
the blonde replied. She was sad about Nate, she added.
Don't be stupid.
The voice came from the doorway, and Tom looked up to see a boy a little younger than him standing there with an annoyed look on his face.
Everyone likes to think Greta's stupid because she's cute. One day, someone is going to underestimate her, and then she'll kick their ass.
He looked pointedly at the girl with no name.
Tom decided he liked the new kid.
I'm Brent, he said.
offering Tom his hand in an oddly formal gesture. It was more than a little unsettling to see a human mimic dandy actions. Tom added Brent's name to his list and mentally underlined it.
"Anyway, that doesn't account for Michael," Brent continued.
"Michael." For a moment, Tom went absolutely still, his heart pounding hard in his chest. "Did that mean..."
"The fledgling," Brent clarified.
Tom tried not to focus on the rush of disappointment.
"He's missing?"
he asked.
"Second one in 2 days," Brent remarked. "Good thing Siska stays close to home."
There was something disconcerting about waking up and knowing that the house, what little of it was awake given the early hour, was in an uproar. Briar threw back the covers on his bed, lamenting the dark blue duvet and matching sheets he'd left back home, and got to his feet. He dressed quickly, knowing that time was of the essence and information was critical. He didn't want to be on the wrong end of the adage, "knowledge is power." He found John Walker in the same parlor that they'd held their last meeting, an untouched cup of tea in his left hand. He was standing near the window, hand outstretched toward the blackout curtains.
"I wouldn't pull that back just yet," Briar remarked,
lounging in the doorway.
"I know," John replied. "Sunset isn't until 7.
Briar turned toward the clock on the mantel. It was barely 5.
"Are you always such an early riser?" Briar asked. He himself was used to sleeping a little later. "Only when there's trouble," John said after a moment. "I could feel it. I just knew." "You could probably hear the house staff prattling on," Briar replied. "That would wake anyone."
"Perhaps," John said distractedly. "There are worse things than to be attuned to those around me." Briar merely nodded at that.
"There is trouble, though," he said, once the silence between them had stretched a little too long. "The humans are upset. Those of us who are awake have been whispering."
"Are you worried that they're keeping secrets?" John asked, with a small, distracted smile.
"This isn't grammar school, Briar. We don't all have to get along."
There were many things that Briar could say to that. He could remind John of his obligation to keep Briar safe, for starters, or even make vague threats about withholding information in the future. Instead, he did his best to wait patiently until John dealt with whatever troubling thoughts were currently taking most of his attention.
"We've lost another fledgling," he said eventually. "And one of the humans, Greta, didn't report in just before dawn."
"Greta? I didn't know they had names,"
Briar scoffed. John looked at him for a long moment, unhappy, but almost unwilling to voice his concern.
"We were going to keep her," John said finally.
"She'd fit in well, we think."
"We?"
Briar asked. "Nate and myself," John replied. "He is too young to do anything about her yet."
"Recruiting from the help?"
Briar asked, surprised.
"Is that why you haven't stopped that other one from dallying with your underlings?"
John's mouth twisted unpleasantly.
"That is a special case," he said. "She won't be around for long, so there's no harm done, so long as it's discreet."
"It's really not,"
Briar laughed. "That's my problem to deal with," John pointed out. "Not yours."
"Fair enough," Briar conceded.
She's not answering her phone. Both Briar and John turned toward the newcomer, one of the younger vampires that Briar had encountered on his arrival to the Dandy House the night before. Faller, Brian thought he was called.
Christopher, you need to calm down, John said, cutting off any possible outbursts the young dandy might have been thinking about making.
I am calm, Faller insisted. I'm not a stupid fledgling, John, and I'm not worried for no reason. There's no answer to either Celeste's home or her cell. She's never completely unreachable.
She's a student. Is she still in class? John asked reasonably.
The look Fowler gave him was not kind, and Briar was possessed with the urge to reach out and slap him upside the head. John managed to make him contrite with nothing more than a quirk of his eyebrow and an irritated frown. Briar was man enough to admit he was impressed.
Her last lecture lets out at 4, Fowler said.
Does she have friends, someone she might be with?
John pressed.
Does your boy have friends?
Fowler asked.
People outside this life who don't know what's going to become of him?
John fell silent at that.
I need to find her,
Fowler insisted.
I need to know that she's safe.
He was near to begging, and Briar fought the urge to roll his eyes.
That, right there, was another reason he had no use for humans. Not only were they fickle and dangerous, but they made you responsible for them. They reduced you to that.
As soon as the sun goes down, John promised. And if you find her...
Briar didn't miss the stricken look that came over Fowler's face.
Bring her back here immediately. We need to round up our people. Things might be crowded for a while.
Has something else happened?
Fowler asked sharply.
Greta didn't return this morning, John explained. And Brent. He apparently went out at noon and hasn't been seen since. Not to mention Michael and Nate.
They're taking them from right under our noses,
Fowler said.
This can't go unpunished.
Don't worry,
John said, clapping Fowler on the shoulder and leading him into the foyer.
As soon as I know who did it, I'll point you in their direction and turn you loose.
Thank you,
Fowler said. The heartfelt gratitude in his eyes made Briar turn away. He stared at the fireplace for several minutes, until he couldn't hear Fowler's footsteps anymore, and he was sure that no one else was going to interrupt them. He turned back to John, and was surprised to find the dandy leader staring at him questioningly, as though trying to decide whether or not to proceed.
I'm going to order a headcount,
John said, after another moment of contemplation. Briar thought of making a joke about grammar schools, but kept the quip to himself. There was something so serious in John's eyes that even Briar, who loved to push the limits, knew to keep silent. Everyone will have an hour after sunset to bring their people here. Not only our house staff and all marked humans like Christopher Celeste. Briar noticed that he didn't draw attention to himself, didn't list Spencer's name. But also any humans who might even have caught someone's eye on the street. If a dandy has ever looked twice at someone, ever thought about the possibility of keeping them, I want to know that they're safe.
Not a small job keeping them settled,
Briar said.
Especially if they're not too keen on the idea.
I have 2 mesmerists in this house, John said. We'll be fine.
And why would you share such information with me, before you've even told your own people?
Briar asked carefully. Because, as you so nicely pointed out last night, you have family in my city. Family at all costs, right?
Right, Briar said slowly.
He'd known it would come back to haunt him, staking a claim to Wentz's hunters, even on Gerard's behalf. Gerard himself had no intention of coming back for them, their marking having been nothing more than a small piece in a grander plan. But still, what had he been expected to do, especially when the butcher had set his sights on them? Briar might not have had much use for humans in general, but he found himself strangely unwilling to let go of that boy. Blue eyes and short brown hair, his mouth twisted into an angry line. So much loyalty to his friends, to one so undeserving as Pete Wentz. He'd fight them, Briar knew. It would be glorious.
I think we have enough excitement here without dangling them in front of the butcher, Briar said. But I'll keep an eye on them regardless.
Your choice, John said.
Briar tried to read his reaction, curious as to whether he was satisfied or unhappy with his decision. He was frustrated to realize that he had no idea what the other vampire was thinking. John excused himself then, intent on catching the rest of his people as they woke. They really couldn't afford to lose any time.
Briar stayed close to the house during the early evening, choosing to delay going out to hunt. He listened as John spoke with his followers, doing his best to calm their fears. The staff was rounded up and housed in the small outbuilding at the edge of Dandy property, where previously an older couple had lived alone. None of the Dandies offered them much by way of explanation, but Briar supposed that wasn't unusual. House staff wasn't meant to ask questions, and the vampires weren't meant to offer up information at random. So long as they stayed at the estate, they'd be safe. That's all anyone had to know. Things were different with the humans who actually mattered. Briar saw Brendan talking quietly with Ryan, John with Spencer, and even Quinn with some tiny brunette, grave expression on his face as he offered up whatever he knew about the situation. Fowler returned empty-handed, his body language closing off with every passing minute, the look on his face growing darker and darker as he eyed the Dandies who still had their humans. It was after 9 when he caught sight of Cardin and John. They were standing in one of the long corridors, arguing quietly. Briar slipped into the kitchen, pressed flat against the wall near the door, and did his best to listen.
"Have you not heard a word I've said?" John hissed. He was beyond angry, and Briar couldn't help but smile and close his eyes a little.
He wished he could see it. The flash of his dark eyes, the twist of his mouth, the set of his eyebrows. He'd heard stories, of course. Years worth of gossip concerning Jonathan Walker and his famous even temper. The pride of Nicholas Skemeka's line.
"I'm not letting someone take him from me, not again," Cardin exclaimed. "We are missing 4 people, according to your headcount."
"Tom isn't allowed to leave the house. That's your rule," John said. "And that will have to do. We've already discussed this. You already know my feelings about it."
"He is not Pete Wentz," Cardin said.
They were discussing whether or not to turn Tom, Briar realized. What would happen if Cardin did? Schechter had no claim on him, but he'd be upset just the same. "I need eyes in that house."
The words came back to him. Officially, those were his orders. Observe and report back. Unofficially, Briar knew he should be doing much more. If Tom was turned, Schechter would lose him, lose whatever it was that connected them. No matter what the future held, Briar was certain that having the boy turned was a bad idea. He was overcome with a wave of annoyance at the thought. The kid was trouble. If he didn't think it would cause even more bad blood between their cities, if it wouldn't upset Schechter to have one of his schemes thwarted, Briar would just let the boy take what was coming to him. He had only a moment to formulate a plan, and it certainly wasn't one of his best. But Briar didn't allow himself to think about it. He stayed silent as John passed him by, moving with long, purposeful strides in his effort to get away from Cardan. It wasn't until the mesmerist followed a few moments later that Briar moved, lounging in the kitchen doorway, intent on getting his attention.
"Trouble, Cardan?"
he asked innocently.
"None that concerns you,"
Cardan replied, not bothering to even spare Briar a glance. The disrespect angered the elder vampire, and he was moving before Cardan could do more than take a single step. His hand closed over the mesmerist's arm, gripping tightly just above the elbow, wrinkling his perfectly pressed suit coat. With one quick jerk, he'd pulled the other vampire backward, making him stumble into the kitchen.
"You take liberties, Briar," Cardan snarled. "You might be an envoy, and people might be afraid of your connection to that fucking seer, but I'm not one of them. I'll thank you to keep your hands to yourself."
No matter the words, Briar smiled regardless. Cardan's language was formal, more so than usual when they dealt with one another. He was being careful. Briar allowed him to pull away, to put more distance between them, not only because he'd made his point, but also because the only place to go was farther into the kitchen. Cardan took his place by the butcher block counter, watching Briar warily.
"Walker doesn't seem very thrilled with you,"
Briar remarked innocently.
"Are you planning something foolish?"
"My actions are none of your business," Cardan replied. Briar tsked and shook his head.
"You won't even humor a guest in your house. Shouldn't I know what's going on?"
"If I thought that you were actually in the dark, maybe I'd tell you," Cardan scoffed. Briar decided to change tracks.
"Fine then. If I already know, then there's no harm in telling me, is there?"
he asked reasonably.
"It's hardly giving up your secrets." "I'm sure you've learned how to eavesdrop in all the years you spent with Schechter and Gabriel," Mike said. "Which means this conversation is pointless. All I'll say to you is that everything will be settled by tomorrow, and then you'll actually have something interesting to report home."
He pushed away from the counter then, intent on sidestepping Briar and leaving the kitchen. Briar watched him go, waiting for the opportune moment to do what was perhaps the stupidest thing he'd ever done. Funny how desperation could make even the smartest, most ruthless of their kind do the most counterproductive things.
"He said Alex."
Briar's words stopped Cardan in the doorway, much the way he'd figured they would. The mesmerist didn't turn around right away. Not until Briar added,
"Didn't he?"
It was a dangerous game to play, to acknowledge the connection that Cardan himself hadn't put together. Briar's mind was screaming at him to end this, to find a lie to cover up what he'd really been about to reveal, but he pushed it aside. He just hoped Cardan wouldn't ask for specifics, such as just when he was supposed to have overheard this particular gem of information.
"So you think you can mock me too?"
Cardan asked, quietly, dangerously. He turned around then, and the fury in his eyes would have given a lesser vampire pause. There was another emotion beneath the anger, something very difficult to pick up, but still there. Briar was reaching out for it before he caught himself, wanting to keep all of his attention focused on the conversation at hand. It wouldn't do to get distracted.
No, but even you should have put it together by now, Briar said. He allowed a smile to play over his face, and knew it was more than a little smug, designed to get the worst possible reaction. Best to throw him off, make him worry. Alex, he continued. How many of those do you suppose our old friend has, anyway? There was the shocked silence Briar had been counting on. Cardin stood stock still in the doorway, processing the information. He looked up then, locking their gazes together, and Briar could see the thinly veiled disbelief on his face. There was something else, too. That mystery emotion that had been bothering Briar since he'd first noticed it. It was stronger suddenly, and Briar knew immediately what it was. He was desperate to reach out for it, to see just what this vampire was afraid of. There was nothing else the emotion could be, not when Briar's talent was screaming to be used. I don't know, Cardin huffed, pulling himself together and taking a step forward. Four? It took Briar a moment to come back to himself, to realize that the other vampire was actually answering a rhetorical question.
Seven,
Briar corrected. It would have been eight if Victoria hadn't gotten to Suarez first. That's always been a sore spot, you know? I can imagine, Cardin said sarcastically. The lack of respect grated on Briar's nerves, and he couldn't help the irritated look he fixed on the mesmerist. They've become quite a joke among your people, Schechter and his little harem. I've heard the stories you tell, the ridiculous disbelief, the borderline insults, he said. I have no idea how people began to believe that he is permissive when it comes to his Alex's. But that can't be farther from the truth. Their upbringing has been as painfully strict as the rest of ours. Though your gossip has gotten one thing right.
What? Cardin asked, almost against his better judgment, if the look on his face was any indication.
Schechter would do anything to secure their happiness,
Briar replied.
He's even given one away to Colligan, of all people.
Cardin was quiet at that, and Briar wondered if he'd had any dealings with Colligan in the past. Possibly, because Cardin didn't seem all that happy to hear him mentioned. Briar supposed he could understand the reaction. He himself had rarely seen such brutality wrapped up in such a sweet-faced package.
Do you want to know why he did that?
Briar pressed, laughing a little.
Because Cash made a sad, terrified boy smile. And putting the newborn with Colligan was better than putting him back in the ground. We sometimes have to put the young ones down, you know that. Beckett did it to Darren's fledgling. And should have done it with Wentz.
Why are you telling me this?
Cardin demanded, crossing his arms tightly over his chest, since his coat was already wrinkled from Briar's rough treatment.
To buy me some time, Briar thought. To cause a distraction. To make sure you think this through,
he said instead.
I don't care who he took up with when he was gone,
Cardin said finally, after a moment of silence.
The fact remains that he's mine here. I can do what I want. And you can reap the consequences,
Briar said simply.
He'll fight you. He'll kill you.
He won't,
Cardin said.
He will,
Briar replied.
He'll do it because he's angry. Bitter. Funny how that's probably what attracted you to him in the first place.
Fuck you,
Carden spat, turning and stalking away.
So eloquent, Briar sighed.
It didn't matter. He had gotten what he wanted.